The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McInnes. 14 years ago, I had an author drop by the station for an interview. He was on book tour for the paperback publication of his first book. It was a novel called The Russian Debutante's Handbook. His name is Gary Steingart. The author was born in the Soviet Union and then moved here as a boy. English was his second language, and he has conquered English. He's one of our funniest writers. He's an amazing humorist. And at the time he wrote this book, he was quite young. He was in his 20s. And as he mentions in our interview, he says, "You write about yourself when you're in your 20s. What else can you write about?" Well, I need to set the mood for this interview, and I think you'll understand as soon as we start playing it back for you why I chose this particular piece of music. Abba, Abba, do. Yeah. Why is he playing Abba? What's the matter? What's gotten into Vic today? Oh, hey, welcome to the Book Nook. I'm Vic McInnes, and I'm playing Abba because Abba is a band that really resonates throughout a new book by Gary Steingart. It's called The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's just come out in paperback, and he joins us in studio. Welcome to Yellow Springs.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
You've come a long way from Oberlin.
Yeah, I went to college in Oberlin, Ohio, which I guess is at the very opposite end of the state. But this Yellow Springs looks really familiar after Oberlin. I'm sure the kids would, too, if they were around.
Tell us about yourself. I understand you emigrated from what was then the Soviet Union in the early 70s.
Yeah, the country I was born in no longer exists. The Soviet Union and the city I was born in, Leningrad, no longer exists either. So, you know, a man without a country and without a city, that's me.
So you live in New York now?
Yeah, I live in New York, which was also New Amsterdam at one point. So these things change. But yeah, I was born in 72 in Leningrad and came to the United States when I was about 7 years old.
Oh, so you were born in 72.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm getting up there.
Is English your second language then?
That's right. I'm a pure ESL child. I grew up, actually, I grew up even writing in Russian. When I was about 4 or 5, I wrote my first little novel that my grandmother commissioned. She paid me in cheese for every page, Soviet cheese, which was pretty frightening. And it was about Lenin and a magic goose that he meets. And Lenin and the goose go and have these wild adventures. So that was my first book. Pretty good book, I think.
It sounds like your grandmother is making an appearance in this new book.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. She's, in fact, I think one of the only characters that is actually sort of there verbatim is my grandmother, you know, because she was quite an influence, and she grew up under Stalin, so she was, she had some baggage coming in, as they say in psychiatric terms. And we lived in Queens, New York, you know, and we lived in this build, and she lived in a building filled with old Russian ladies. They're all 70, 80. All the husbands died in the Second World War or in the labor camps. So it was all these old ladies, and they just kept denouncing one another. So they call up, you know, Social Security and say, "Yo, Galina Petrovna is a bad woman. She is stealing Social Security income." And a friend of mine who runs a radio station in New York, a Russian radio station, he started what he calls Denunciation Hour. And that's an hour where people just, he just lets all the senior citizens from Russia, they just call in and just denounce each other. And it's a beautiful thing to hear, you know. It's very impressive.
Your protagonist in this new book, is he partly you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, if you're writing a book in your 20s, hey, it's you. What else do you know at that point? So yeah, there's a lot of similarities. I think we were both born in former USSR, and we both came to this country and had a really rough time of it at first. You know, I came during the war with Afghanistan. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan, and being a little Russian kid was not pretty. So. He and I both share this, my protagonist, Vladimir Grushkin, and I both share this incredible sense of who the heck are we, you know, and I go back to Russia a lot and I feel uncomfortable there. And so I think I feel most comfortable when I'm on a plane between America and the Eastern Europe, because everyone around me is a foreign national and is just jabbering away in some strange tongue. So I enjoy that a lot.
You finished this book in Baku?
Yeah, I was in Azerbaijan, which is this wacky oil-rich republic, because I'm researching a wacky oil-rich republic for my second book, which is tentatively titled Absurdistan. And so I went to see the Absurdistanis in their natural habitat, and I got to know, traveled all over the place, met some wild and completely insane people who were all affiliated with various governments there and wanted me to. You know, the thing is, wherever I go, the criminal element in the former Soviet Union just comes running out with open arms, and they wanted me to get involved with this scheme to defraud U.S. charities out of $600 million. I mean, it's just insane stuff, and they kept saying, you know, you can speak English and Russian, you know, you're Jewish, so you must be very greedy and clever, so you're gonna help us out here, you know, you're gonna. And they still send me emails, you know, what about the money? What about the $600 million we're gonna steal? You know?
We have a social service worker at work at the beginning of your new book, and his clientele is mostly other Russians, and he's a failure. His mother is highly successful, and what she call him, failure something.
Failurechka, which is little, means little failure. It's a, yeah.
And his father's a physician. His parents have done well.
His parents have done very well. Yeah, they've achieved the American dream, but the kid hasn't.
And the kid's got a relationship of sorts with a woman named Hala.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And she's a dominatrix.
Yes. Yeah. 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 There was a real Hala out there whom I knew, who was this really overweight dominatrix in Manhattan, and the clients just loved her because she was this incredible mother figure, and she was really beloved by Swiss bankers in New York, and they kept scheduling appointments with her, so she was really big in every sense of the word. She was a powerful woman.
And one day this client walks in, and he's got on all his Soviet medals, and Vladimir is sure he's just some other wacko.
Yeah.
And this is where the story really begins.
This is where the story begins. And this is a very true-to-life parallel, because I used to work for a social service agency where all these mad Russians would show up. And one day this guy came in with a crutch, an old 70-year-old Russian invalid came in and just started beating up everybody, the security guard, the social workers. You know, he was probably in his 70s and completely, a complete loon, you know, and just started hitting people. And so I was sent out to pacify him, and I became pretty good buddies with him. You know, I said, look, you can't hit these people all the time. So I'd run out there with some sedatives, and, you know, like when you shoot an elephant with a horse tranquilizer, I kind of stun him a little, and then we'd get him into an office and calm him down. So after I met him, I thought, oh, my God, I've got to start writing a book about all this stuff. And I think one of the things was, you know, that he was just a perfect metaphor for all the insanity that had gone on in my grandparents' day, in my parents' days in the Soviet Union. He was just completely mad, but yet very lyrical and eloquent, you know, which is a very Russian characteristic. So his speech was just beautiful. He was even, well, before we gave him his meds, he really spoke very eloquently about his plight.
So where does reality merge into your imagination in this work?
Well, it merges in it quite a few times. I think, like we said, this character named the Fan Man is one example of it. And also I went to Prague, which is sort of the stand-in city in Eastern Europe where a lot of the action takes place. And I lived about, you know, I lived almost a year there, and it was just very interesting stuff. There were about 30,000 Americans there at the time. This was the early 1990s. And if you recall, Bill Clinton had been there and had a big pork sandwich with Václav Havel, the president. So after that, the floodgates opened, and there were tens of thousands of people. A lot of them, actually, I remember from Ohio, from schools like Oberlin and maybe Antioch. So there were a lot of them there, and everybody thought they were the next Hemingway. So there were all these parties you would go to because Prague was supposed to be the Paris of the 90s, you know, or as I call it, the Soho of Eastern Europe. So everybody and their mother was there and just hanging out and all these awful reading series, ugh, with names like Beef Stew, you know, it was just unbelievable stuff. And there was very little talent, but there was a lot of posturing and there were a lot of men, you know, looking for leggy Czech blondes, and I think they all got some action. So it was quite a scene, quite a scene.
And early in the book, you refer to Antioch College, and that goes right up.
Yeah, I do refer to Antioch College. I guess to the policy, what was it, the sexual conduct policy that they had?
Right.
Is that still around, by the way?
Oh, I'm sure it is.
I'm sure it is, yeah.
But 10 years ago, it got in the news, and you know how the news tends to exaggerate.
Yeah. Well, that was exactly when I was writing the book. And, you know, I was at Oberlin at the time, and I thought, wow, they're going further than we are here. You know, we may have a clothing optional dorm, but they've got a sexual, that kind of policy. So I just... You know, I think a lot of writers, what they do is you were sort of just like a garbage, a wastebasket, you know, and stuff keeps pouring in, all kinds of different little tidbits and pieces of information, and we just sort of try to recycle it into a big narrative. And I love hearing about stuff like that, about Antioch sexual policy. I just thought it was great.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back into our Book Nook archive for an interview I did 14 years ago with Gary Steingart for his first novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook. He came through Dayton on book tour, and it just goes to show how much has changed over the years in publishing. When a virtually unknown author like Gary Steingart was then got sent to Dayton, Ohio on book tour, those were different times. Now we very rarely get unknown authors coming through the area at all. So I'm so glad I had the opportunity to meet him back in the day. And when he arrived here on the campus of Antioch College, he was very much reminded of his days on the campus of Oberlin College. And I loved listening to this first interview with him. I've interviewed him for all four of his books, and I'd forgotten that he talks about things in this first interview that reference his later work. He talked about his second novel that was in progress called Absurdistan. He also talks about the nickname that his parents gave him in Russian when he was a little boy. They called him Little Failure. And Gary ended up writing a book that was a memoir, his most recent book, and the title of it was Little Failure. The Best of the Book Nook. We'll continue with my interview with Gary Steingart right after this. My guest is Gary Steingart. The book is The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Being Jewish is one thing, but apparently being Jewish and Russian is entirely different.
Yeah, oh my God. I mean, you've got two peoples that have been through so much in the past century, both Jews and Russians, and I mean, if you're just Jewish, you've been through God knows what, and if you're Russian, well, you've lived through Stalin, and that, you know, so you got Hitler on one side, Stalin on the other, and, you know, if you're Jewish and Russian, well, it's a mental health crisis from hell. I mean, I just, my God, you know, that's just so much to deal with, so much angst and so much anxiety. So in a way, you know, I guess I started writing this book really because I thought there really wasn't anything Russian-Jewish from my generation, the people that came in the early 70s, in the late 70s, you know, people who were in their late 20s, early 30s. There really wasn't anyone like that writing a book. And I looked at the bookstores and, you know, there were Haitians, Dominicans, Chinese, Koreans, all really great writers from every corner of the globe, young people my age, and nothing from us. And I got so distraught. I thought, what, you know, here we come from this literary tradition, bar none. And there's nothing on the shelf. And, you know, I said, I got to write something just to fill in the gaps there. So that's how I got started.
Is all that talent being wasted grifting? I mean, what's going on?
Whose talent? Mine or the characters?
These other writers that aren't producing anything.
Oh, they're producing. Oh, yeah. Well, I always have this argument with my Russian friends about why aren't others writing. And I think after this book came out, the floodgates are starting to open, and there's a lot of other Russians my age who are starting to come out with collections of short stories and stuff, which is very encouraging. I think there are two things. One is we have these parents who push us incessantly into the law, banking, dentistry, and medicine. You know, and the question they always ask is, well, you are a writer, but who are you by profession? So they can't seem to figure out that, that being a writer, you know, that one can earn one's daily bread from it, although it's certainly hard. So there's that kind of immigrant. But, it's, you know, the Korean families I know are the same way, and yet there's all, half a dozen great Korean-American writers. So I don't know if that argument holds water entirely. And another argument is that, you know, growing up, we really, the idea was if you had some kind of problems, you kept it inside. You really didn't advertise it. You didn't air the dirty laundry. And I think that any act of any immigrant writer who is worth his or her salt is in a way committing an act of betrayal just by publicizing what is often a very unhealthy way of living to others, to the community at large. So,
what were your parents like?
Well, they're not like the parents in the book in that they're not criminals. I don't think they are. I haven't been down to the basement in a while, but I think it's all kosher down there. And my father was a nuclear engineer, so he did that for a while. And he was a nuclear engineer here as well, and he retired recently. And my mother actually did work for an agency or is about to – she's about to retire, an agency that does resettle immigrants. So there's some parallel there too.
What do they think of your book?
Well, I think they were really shocked when it came out because just like I said, you know, it was – just a shock, and all these reporters came to our house and interviewed them, and they printed all these articles about them, and some of them were really off. You know, like one of them said something like, "Oh my, the mother in the book is exactly like the mother in the in real life," and the mother in the book is psychotic, and so my mother naturally was not very happy about that. So, I'm glad she didn't sue them, but you know, it was an interesting experience for them to get all this notoriety. But they're handling it well. I mean, they're very happy for me, and that's, you know, I think they probably wouldn't mind if I did go to law school at some point. But it's nice to, and also, you know, they're having trouble reading it also because their level of English is probably not good enough to understand everything. Uh-huh. But there's a Russian translation down the pike, so they'll get a chance to sink their teeth into that one.
Well, I know a lot of writers who have English as a first language who don't come anywhere close to the way you use the language. And I just think it's amazing. I just love the way you write.
Well, thank you very much. But, you know, I got to say that I'm not alone in this. I think there are so many brilliant writers. I mean, obviously, Vladimir Nabokov is sort of the gold standard among any immigrant writers. He came when he was in his 40s. Well, granted, Nabokov had an English governess growing up, so, you know, which is not something we had back in Leningrad. Mm-hmm. So he had that advantage. But you know the guy, Alexander Hemond, you know him? He wrote The Question of Bruno, Nowhere Man. He's a great Bosnian writer, I know, a friend of mine. And he actually lives in Chicago. And he came here at 29, writes the most exquisite prose you can imagine. Conrad is another example.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Gary Steingart. The book is The Russian Debutante's Handbook. I don't know how many of the plot details you want to give away. I mean, we start off, we've got this invalid coming into this welfare office, and he's making a big scene, and then Vladimir ends up going to his house. Do you want to talk about what happens? Or?
A little bit, sure. I mean, he ends up getting an offer he can't refuse to work for a Russian mafioso named the Groundhog in the former Eastern Europe. And at first, Vladimir says, no, I can't possibly do this. But then he gets entangled. He dumps his dominatrix girlfriend and starts pining for a real New York socialite, a real example of the kind of intellectual, the kind of woman that I knew in Oberlin over and over and over again. And so he does everything in his power to woo her and her parents. And in the end, he just keeps running out of money because, it takes a lot of money to be a New York socialite. You know, I can't even come up with half of it at this point. So God knows. So he does his best. And through a weird series of events, he ends up impersonating the son of a drug lord in Miami, Florida, and things there turn very ugly, and he has to flee back to Eastern Europe where he hooks up with the groundhog. And before that happens, there's a fake naturalization ceremony, you know, and it's very interesting. When the book came out, it got very good reviews, but some people said, oh, but it's just so outlandish. And some people pointed out the fake naturalization ceremony that I had for these immigrants. And 2 months after that happened, it happened in real life in Los Angeles. There was this it wasn't Russian, it was some Mexican guys had, you know, they built these poor immigrants out of their money and staged this fake naturalization ceremony. So, and a lot of other things in this book have happened as well. So it's just a little, in some ways, I'm not even keeping up with reality. Forget about going beyond reality. And the second book I'm writing about, you know, that I thought of a couple of years ago, it's about an oil-rich republic that undergoes a tremendous civil war. And I'm turning on the news, and I just feel like events again have outpaced me. So it's hard to be on the cutting edge of things.
Well, truth is usually stranger.
A lot stranger.
Yeah.
A lot stranger.
The book is A Russian Debutante's Handbook. Gary Steingart wrote it. And I love the gangster segments. I love the groundhog and his men, and you've got the scene where they're in the bath, and Vladimir is allowed to scourge the groundhog, and this really upsets this other guy.
Yeah. It's a tradition in the Russian baths. You take it's called a vyenik, and it's a sort of it can be a bunch of things. Sometimes it looks like a broom. It could be a bunch of birch twigs, you know, sort of tied together, and you whip the person usually against the back, and it's sort of supposed to improve circulation. I think it's just an act of, you know, state-sanctioned violence or bathhouse-sanctioned violence. I could never figure it out. It hurts like hell.
It's ritual flagellation, isn't it?
Ritual flagellation. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. And so in my book, when the hero knows he's an up-and-coming gangster when he's allowed to whip the groundhog, the main guy, across the back. So I've never done that, I have to admit. I could never really join the Russian mafia. I think they have a height requirement that I don't pass. So it's a tough one. But it's interesting. You learn a lot in the baths when you're surrounded by a bunch of sweaty Russian men, and usually there's vodka and some kind of dried fish hanging around, and you chew the fat, you chew the fish, and you learn a lot. You make a lot of deals that way.
I was reading the book, and of course when I read the Antioch reference, I flinched. And then I got a little further, and I'm from Des Moines, and I went to a high school in Des Moines where we had more Jewish students than any other high school in Iowa.
Wow. So
I'm reading your book, and we get to Prava, and we meet this writer in a bar, and his name is Cohen.
Yeah, and Perry Cohen.
You describe him as the only Jew in Iowa?
Yeah. He describes himself as the only Jew in Iowa. I'm familiar that there are probably 20 more. So.
And he's from Des Moines.
He's from Des Moines. Yeah, I don't remember that. That's right. You're right. That's good.
Wow. Yeah, that really scared me.
I'm writing your life, basically.
I knew a guy named Cohen. In high school.
Well, if there's Jews, there's bound to be at least one Cohen. Yeah.
He probably went to Prague or Prava.
I'm sure he went to Prague. I'm sure. So, yeah, I met a bunch of guys there who were – it's really funny. I mean, even in New York, you meet all these Jewish guys who are like, I was the only one in the state, you know. And I'm always a little doubtful. But when they say something like North Dakota, I think, well, maybe there's a chance. But.
Well, it's that sense of isolation. They're just making it seem a little more extreme than it might have been.
Yeah, but I'm sure that there was a unique sense of isolation there is whenever you're one of anything. I mean, if you were a Sikh or you know, some kind of a Afghani growing up in Bismarck, I'm sure life is complicated, to say the least. You know?
I think one of my favorite images that you conjure up in this book is the foot.
The foot, yeah. Yeah, the foot. That's one of the reasons why the city in the book is in Prague. It's called Prava. It's a fictional city, and one of the reasons I wanted was to get this giant statue of Stalin's foot in there, and I wanted the statue of Stalin's foot to lord over the skyline of this old city, and I wanted from wherever you are in the city, you see this giant foot hanging over it. It's a pretty obvious metaphor, obviously, the legacy of Stalinism in all these different countries. But Prague actually did have a giant statue of Stalin, one of the biggest, if not the biggest in the world. And if you've ever seen a picture of Prague or been to Prague, it is an absolutely gorgeous city. So you can imagine this huge monstrosity. And after 56, they blew up the statue. But it was so big that it took a long time for it to blow up. So they would blow up, like, you know, you woke up one day and the left arm was gone or the head was gone. And eventually the whole thing was gone. But I can imagine at one point maybe there was a foot left standing. And that was sort of my imaginative gateway into building the statue of Stalin's foot. And a lot of the plot revolves around an effort to get rid of it. So
that last vestige of oppression.
Yeah, the last vestige of oppression before the Starbucks move in, yeah.
Yeah, which is even more impressive in my book.
Yeah.
The Russian Debutante's Handbook, I kept trying to figure out how you came up with this title.
we had about 100 titles, each one worse than the next. Oh, God. I mean, the Assimilationist, how's that for an awful title? How about The Pyramids of Prague? That's pretty bad, right?
Yeah, didn't just Caleb Carl write you write The Assimilationist?
The Assimilationist. If he hasn't, he sure it's the sequel. Yeah, it was. And what's interesting is that it really, a debutante, it's spelled with an E, and that's not accurate because it's a male.
Because it'd be a female.
Yeah.
Right.
This
okay.
is a male. Vladimir Grushkin is the debutante.
Okay.
So, but we thought it would confuse readers too much to have it without the E, just to have it with the TS ending. So we left it in. And to confuse the reader even further.
There's the picture.
There's the picture of a gorgeous young woman. I don't know what her number is, but I'm trying to find out. And she's just sitting there on this gorgeous couch and looking really kind of, you know, cynical and all New York-y and stuff. And so she looks gorgeous, and a lot of young male readers, I think that that's the debutante. And then they plunk down their money for the book thinking it's going to be a wild sex romp. And then they open it up, and there's like, well, there's not one really hot character in here at all, you know. So it's a bit of a scam. It's a pyramid scheme.
I see. This is a Ponzi cover.
Yeah, it's a Ponzi cover. That's right.
Well, you've gotten all these accolades from all these different people. I was reading through your reviews, and I thought, holy smokes, you know. How do you keep from getting, like, an overinflated head?
Oh, I just wake up, and I have this mantra, you know, I am nothing, I am nothing, hear me roar, you know. I actually wrote a song, what was it? I am ethnic, hear me roar, from Taipei to Bangalore, I am ethnic, ethnic, and so on. So that's my little tune. Yeah, that's, you know, I just keep saying to myself, look, you know, your grandparents were probably, your great-great-grandparents were probably dung farmers in some shtetl, you know, who don't get such a big head over it. You know, and then there's the second book, and that can fail miserably. So I'm almost hoping for that, the so-called sophomore slump, and then that'll set me right. You know, that'll teach me a good lesson.
How did you get a deal? How did you get a publisher?
Through a professor of mine named Chang Ray Lee, who's a great Korean-American writer. I was taking a course with him. Well, I was going to apply. I applied to the MFA, the Master of Fine Arts program he teaches. And he said, he read it, and he said, well, why don't we just get you a book deal right now? And a week later, his editor had signed it on. So it's one of those rather miraculous stories.
Is that at Oberlin?
No, this is at Hunter College in New York City.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Chang Ray Lee.
Chang Ray Lee, who wrote Native Speaker and A Jester Life and a bunch of other great books. Very smart guy. I was giving a speech recently, and somebody said, asked him, why do you write? Or, you know, what inspires you? And he said, I write because the books that I want to read haven't been written yet. And that's a great answer. And that's why I write. And I think that's why, you know, I turn through literature and so modern literature, and so much of it does excite me. A lot of it actually in America these days is really good. But the exact stuff that I want to read are not out there yet. And that's what gets me, wakes me up in the morning and turns me onto the laptop because I want to get this right. Somebody's got to, what was it? It was Mandelstam, the Russian poet, something like, read me, hear me. That was one of his poems. And I think that's sort of the feeling I get.
Is that the whole poem?
No. Read me, hear me roar. I am ethnic, etc.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. It's the Best of the Book Nook this morning, revisiting an interview I did with Gary Steingart for his first novel. I love meeting authors who have just published their first novels. They are so innocent and so unspoiled. And in the case of Gary Steingart, so funny. His career lay ahead of him, and this book that he had just published at the time, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, won the Stephen Crane Award for First Fiction. It was the Book of the Month Club First Fiction Award winner, and it also won the National Jewish Book Award for Fiction. It was named a New York Times Notable Book and one of the best debuts of that year by The Guardian newspaper. He was named one of the five best new writers by Shout New York magazine back in the day. And he also was named one of the New Yorker magazine's 20 under 40 luminary fiction writers. Of course, that was a long time ago because now he's 45 years old. His most recent book was his memoir, Little Failure. The Best of the Book Nook will continue with our final segment right after this.
My guest is Gary Steingart. The book is The Russian Debutante's Handbook. Don't be fooled by the title or the picture on the cover. It's very funny. It's not a total sex romp, even though there is a little, just a little tiny bit of sex.
Just a little bit of sex in Antioch.
Lots of drinking.
Lots of drinking. Oh, God, so much drinking. I mean, I look back at it, and of course there are autobiographical elements here, and I just think, did I really drink all that? In my 20s, you know, I just turned 30, and my liver is seeking asylum in Canada. It's unbelievable what... And I go back to Russia, and I see my friends, and, you know, you get together with some guys, and everybody brings their own bottle of vodka. And if you don't consume all of it by the end, well, you're just an American or something.
So, that is sad.
Yeah, sad.
Well, Vladimir, when he gets to Prava and figures out what the prices are like, he immediately calculates how many drinks he can have that week. I think it was like 5,000.
5,000. It's really funny. That was the first thing we realized when we came to Prague, was that beer was about 20 cents for a giant pint of, you know, like a Czech pint. So that's probably a gallon or something. And it was just amazing. The drunkenness and the debauchery that went on, just because... And it's not that way anymore. I go back to Prague every once in a while, and it's you know, turning into like a little sliver of Western Europe almost. It's Prague, the center of it anyway, is so filled with German tourists these days that you really can't get a good beer for under $1 at all. Mm.
I'm guessing the groundhog is probably one of many real people.
No, the groundhog is not as real as some of the other people.
But I'm guessing there's a lot of people like the groundhog.
Oh, yes, there's a lot of groundhog-like people. You know, when the after the Soviet Union collapsed, there were so many really not very bright but very aggressive people who were sort of somehow either affiliated with the old regime or with the black market people who were running around making deals and really not very bright but really just primed to take advantage of the collapse of really an entire society at that point. And these are the people responsible, in a way, for Russia's terrible state. And a lot of them actually do live in Prague and Budapest. A lot of these Russians live in the Czech Republic and Hungary and work out of there because it's sort of a nice sort of conduit between the two. And a lot of them do. They smuggle young prostitutes. They control the drug trade. They control all kinds of weird industries like they used to control. I don't know if they still do the taxi business in Prague. Mm. So if you wanted to get an airport in the taxi, that was all Russian mob control. So there was a lot of that stuff, and it was really interesting. They are changing. Back in the book, for instance, a lot of them are wearing these Adidas tracksuits that used to be sort of the signature of the Russian mobster. And when I go back now, they're learning really quickly. Maybe my book is teaching them, but they're buying a lot of khaki pants and Ralph Lauren polo kind of shirts, and they're starting to, you know, they're still these fat, ugly human beings, but good God, they're dressed a lot better. No more tracksuits.
In your view, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, now we're 15 years past that or so,
12 years.
Is it better for the average Russian?
It's much worse, I think, for the average Russian. I mean, you know, you can't beat democracy and free speech, and that's something Russia hasn't had in a long time. And, you know, there are some constraints. The current government tries to crack down on the media a lot when there's reporting that shows what's really going on in Chechnya, for instance. The Putin administration is very keen on cracking down. And so it's not a perfect democracy by any stretch of the imagination. But the problem really lies in the fact that there's no civil society. And the country is so screwed up mentally from the mental point of view, and also just the infrastructure has almost entirely collapsed, and the average income is now about $1,500 per capita. This used to be a middle-class country, at least nominally speaking, and now it's become a country that's almost a part of the developing world. So that happened, and at the same time, there's so little hope for young people, outside of Moscow especially, because there's no middle class. There was a recent poll of young college-educated Russians, and about 80% said they wanted to leave the country as soon as they could. That's a frightening statistic. Mm. And the ones that can, for the most part, do leave, or at least flock to Moscow, which is the only city with any kind of normal Western lifestyle is even remotely possible. And that leaves a lot of the regions just completely – a complete brain drain in the regions. So it's so depressing. It's – I'm moving to Italy in October for a year and a half. Just so I can not go to Russia for a while and just hang out in a nice sunny country, because it's depressing to go back, and I try to go back every year. So.
Well, what do you think of America?
Well, it's interesting. You know, this is the sort of, I'm on a 20-city tour, and it's almost this biblical tour, 40 days and 40 nights of seeing the country. I don't know. It's really strange. I've realized now, and I've known it before, but there really are two coasts, the East Coast and the West Coast, and then there's what's in between, and the two are as different as two countries can be and still have the same flag. It's unbelievable to hear. I mean, of course, you have pockets of the coast inside America, and you have pockets of the interior of America on the coasts as well. So it's not perfectly drawn that way. But pretty much the electoral map, the way we saw it last time around, I think that the blue and the red states, I think that really says a lot. And it's just amazing. It's just amazing. Just even the subtle differences. I met a friend of mine in Cincinnati, and she said, have you checked out your television in the hotel? And I said, yeah, I have. And she said, notice there's no porn in there. And I was shocked. I didn't really think of that. But apparently there's some Cincinnati law against the so it's just two very different way of thinking, and I think the way that things have come out in terms of the war, you know, the way, for instance, New York was the city that suffered the most under 9/11, but there's so many war protests all across the city, and it's just a whole different picture. And so one gets really surprised just coming out into a place like Cincinnati, just so different.
So you didn't tell your friend that you'd already called the front desk and complained?
Yeah, right.
You know, Jerry Springer used to be the mayor of Cincinnati.
I know. That's really funny.
Yeah, Cincinnati is a very unusual place.
Very unusual.
What kind of cities are they sending you to? Is it mostly East and West Coast?
It's mostly East and West Coast, but this is interesting. They do send me to places like Cleveland, for instance.
Well, you mentioned Cleveland in the book
quite a bit. I mentioned Cleveland in the
book. You even mentioned Dayton once.
I did mention Dayton, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned it because, let's see. Oh, one of the heroines of the book is from Ohio, from Shaker Heights, Cleveland. And she once went to a basketball camp in Dayton, and she's
pretty This is Morgan?
Morgan is her name, yeah. So, Ohio does play a big role in my imagination just because it is the part of America that I know the most, and that's not saying a lot, other than New York, of course. So when I close my eyes and try to imagine the rest of this country, I do think mostly of Cleveland, which is also a very unusual city. Sometimes the suburbs look like New Jersey, but the inside looks a little like, Syracuse, New York or something.
Uh-huh.
Very, very strange kind of a post-industrial town.
We call it Rust Belt.
Rust Belt, yeah. But, you know, this is fascinating. I'm really having a good time just venturing out. I go to Europe so much, and just to go get out and see America, I mean, what the heck? I have the citizenship, right? Might as well see the rest of the country. So I'm looking forward not just to the West Coast, but also places like Denver, you know, Milwaukee. That's going to be interesting.
You going to the Tattered Cover in Denver?
The Tattered Cover, that's right.
That's a great bookstore.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. Where else that I haven't been? Oh, well, Miami I've been to, but I love that place so much. I go wild for Miami. I think it's fascinating. And the food and the Cuban beat, just great. Great stuff.
There's a photo on the back of the book, and I wasn't really sure that this was you. But there's a photo on the back of the book, and you're sitting there, and you've got your bear with you. And I thought, well, this had to be posed.
Yeah, well, that's Misha the bear. No, actually, that picture wasn't posed. I met a bear when I was in St. Petersburg 2 years ago. I was taken. Nice bear. You know, I introduced myself. There's a lot of guys walking around with bears. It's really strange. I was coming out of the metro station in Petersburg, and this guy walked out, and he had his – this is a small bear on the cover, but – Misha's a pretty small, he's a bear cub, but this guy walks out and he's got a huge bear on a leash and he's coming out of the subway and the guy is drunk and the bear is drunk and they're just staggering down the street and the bear starts growling and the guy starts growling. It was just a sort of primordial man with bear scene, you know. I just wish maybe a Renaissance painter was around to paint it. It was just beautiful.
I find that frightening, that image of a drunken bear coming out of the subway. This is one of the funnier books that I've read lately. I laughed and laughed and laughed throughout the book. Just the way Vladimir reacts to things. I mean, this guy really doesn't have a moral center of any kind, does he?
Yeah, he really doesn't have a moral center. And I love those kinds of heroes. In the second book also, the second book features a 400-pound Russian rapper who has absolutely no moral center whatsoever. He has a manservant whom he whips, you know. I mean, it's just... These kinds of characters are very prominent in Russian fiction. You think of a guy named like Oblomov, for instance, or any of Gogol's heroes, really, the hero of dead souls, for instance, you know. So that's a very prevalent theme, the sort of anti-hero without a moral compass, flailing around. In a lot of these books, by the end of the book, you find some sort of morality. And I guess my hero does as well. He decides to settle down in a, oh, should I give it away? Probably not. But
No,
I won't give it away. But he decides to settle down in some way, and you'll see how if you read the book. And so I do think that there's a kind of ending. I hope it's not a Hollywood-type ending, but I do think that one, after a while, one does tend to settle down and find some kind of compass. I certainly have.
I don't think it was Hollywood at all. So you've settled down?
No, actually, you're right. I haven't. Well, my moral compass has hit, you know, true north, I think. But
okay.
Settling down, no. I'm going to Italy for a year and a half. Then I'm going to, I don't know where the heck I'm going to go after that. I may move back to New York for a while. Part of me really wants to live in a small American town for a while just because I can't write convincing American scenes. I don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, outside of New York, which is its own little country.
Well, move here. We'll leave you alone.
No, absolutely. Well, I don't want you to leave me alone.
But I mean, we'll let you do what you need to do.
I'll come to Yellow Spring without a second thought. It seems nicer than Oberlin, the town at least.
Much nicer. So are you going to be in Italy to write? Is that your escape?
Yes, my escape, because the second book is coming due soon, so I got a year and a half to finish it up, so I got to go there, because I can't seem to get anything done in New York. And I won this bizarre fellowship to spend a lot of time with this baroness who owns a castle outside of Florence. So I'm going to be she's pretty cool, I think, and I'm going to be living in this giant tower.
Really?
Yeah, with three other writers. So
what's the town?
Donini. It's in Tuscany.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Are the other writers people we might know?
I know Michael Cunningham is coming at some point, the guy that wrote The Hours, but I don't know if he's going to be there with me because it sort of, you know, it rotates. Suki Kim is going to be there. She's a great young Korean-American author who wrote the book The Interpreter and a friend of mine, so I was shocked when I realized I was going to be there with her at the same time.
So are there just like rows of garrets and you walk by and there's an author in each one? And
I think it's I could be wrong. I mean, I've been trying to figure this out. I think there's a tower and there's rooms in the tower. So, you know, I guess you just knock on each other's door and say, hey, Steingart, let's go get a jug of wine and frolic.
Yes, and ignore our writing obligations.
Yeah, ignore exactly.
You mentioned the fact that the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S. are so different. When I think of Italy, when you go from one area to another, you talk about different.
Talk about different. Sicily and, say, Emilia-Romagna, where Milan is, are about as different. And there's a huge movement in Italy among the northerners who feel they're superior to the southerners and who feel they subsidize them with taxes to separate and create two Italies. I think Florence would be sort of the most southern city in the new northern Italy. So it's a strange, strange movement.
And tell us the significance of ABBA to the plot, because our listeners were probably really perplexed by the fact that we played ABBA. ABBA keeps coming back in this book.
ABBA to us was, and I'm really glad you played that. That really made me feel at home. ABBA to us was so important, I have to say. It was just, look, it's schlock, it's kitsch, but it was from Sweden. It was right next door, and there was something so bright and cheerful about it. I mean, look, they're not the Beatles, and the Beatles certainly had some, you know, they had gravitas to their music, and that was the other thing that was very popular, of course, in Russia. But ABBA was just such happy, silly music, Dancing Queen. You would hear that so much in Russian. The first record I heard was an ABBA record growing up. And when I moved to Oberlin, when I went to school in Oberlin, that was sort of the kitsch disco song that Dancing Queen and Super Trooper, you know, and you go to the SCO, it's called, which is the disco in Oberlin, and quarter beer night, you know, you get a little beer for 25 cents and dance away to ABBA. And I close my eyes and ignore the Ohio landscape around me, I could almost picture I was back in Leningrad.
You even make a reference to the Great Lakes Brewing Company in your book.
Yeah.
And this was Morgan had some paraphernalia from there.
The Great Lakes Brewing Company. A lot of fun times there. Yeah. I was in Cleveland yesterday. So much nostalgia even landing at Cleveland Hopkins International Airport, you know, and I remember flying in from New York. And there was a weird excitement even to being in northeastern Ohio coming from New York because Oberlin was such an intense place, you know. 3,000 people, at least half of them were poets and oboe players, you know. And all these weird incestuous affairs everybody was having with everybody else. It was like a Bloomsbury, but under the gray Ohio sky, northern Ohio, I should add.
So do you always carry two pens?
That's another reference to the book. You really read the book. I'm glad you could quote it at such length. Yeah, I always do carry two pens. One of the characters in the book says, a writer must always carry two pens. And that's Cohen, actually, who's being his most obnoxious at that point. So I do.
Well, thanks for a very funny book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back in the Buckeye State.
Come back with the next book.
I will, absolutely.
This has been the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2003 interview with Gary Steingart for the Russian Debutante's Handbook. I'm picturing Gary, they knew him as Scary Gary, back on the campus of Oberlin, dancing at the disco at Oberlin to this by ABBA.